Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a reading and conversation presented by the Poetry Reading Series at the College of General Studies. Our speaker is American poet David Ferry. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler.
He's the author of 6 books of poems and the translator of Gilgamesh, the Odes and Epistles of Horace, and the Eclogues and Georgics of Virgil, and he's at work right now on a translation of the Aeneid. In 2011, he was awarded...
I'm almost finished.
Almost finished with the Aeneid. In 2011, he was awarded the $100,000 Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize for Lifetime Achievement. He's also winner of the 2012 National Book Award for his volume, Bewilderment. Let me read you a few lines from one of his poems. This is from Seen Through a Window. And I'm kind of interested in his technique because he takes what appears to be a very ordinary scene or an everyday moment, and he imbues it with something that's not quite earthly or not quite of this earth. In this poem, it happens with a particular color, the color green. And he seems to press it through different prisms, or he holds it up, so we're looking at it from peculiar angles and seeing it anew. Because thinking about his technique, I was wondering, what is it that's so magical? And it's this first looking at something on the surface, and then the observation becomes one of depth, no longer looking at the surface, but deep into it. A man and a woman are sitting at a table. It is supper time. The air is green. The walls are white in the green air, as rocks under water retain their own true color, though washed in green. I do not know either the man or the woman, nor do I know whatever they know of each other. Though washed in my eye, they keep their own true color. Seems that the move he makes is also a movement of mind, from surface vision to depth vision. And it all happens so quickly and seamlessly, we aren't even aware of the change occurring until we find ourselves there in that new and resonant place. I welcome David Ferry.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. I'm going to have to do a certain amount of shuffling of papers because my eyes are shot and I can't read from my own books. So please be patient about that. I'd like to start with the only 2 new poems that I have from my last book. I have the title of my next book, which I'll never get to write because I'm 91, and it's Underworld, which is a great title for a book. But these poems may have something to do with that. One is called Who Is It? Here inside this fiction of myself, 2 voices I always hear, both of them mine, I guess. One of them telling the truth, I guess. I don't know which one it is that's telling the truth. The voice that said what it was it had to say, and heard what it said when it said it, and didn't know exactly what had become of the person who said what it was he said just now, to tell the truth. Always like this. Always it's been like this. The one that told my parents who I was, told my wife who I was, told my children, and told whoever it was I was talking to. So help me God. Telling the truth. So help me. And this is a poem, the other new one, is called Something. There's mention in it of a fantôme sans eau, a phrase from Ronsard's great poem, Quand vous serez bien vieille au soir à la chandelle, assise auprès du feu, dévidant et filant, and so on. And there's a reference also to the Gilgamesh, to the Tablet 12, the poem that's a Sumerian poem that the Babylonians translated. It's not part of the major Gilgamesh epic, but a separate poem. And in it, Gilgamesh sends Enkidu, the wild man, who became his servant, companion, boyfriend, brother, who knows, down into the underworld to come back and tell him how it is down there. And Enkidu comes back as a puff of breath to tell him the story, the unbearable story. Something. Drifting across the page that I'm writing on, is it the ghost of a so-called Holy Spirit? Is it the drifting ghost of the cigarette smoke from back in the day when I smoked? Is it the voice, unbodied, speaking to me, that phantom sans eau, Ronsard, rising up from his grave, tells us he is? Is it the voice of Enkidu, Tablet 12, come up through a hole in the upper world floor to breathe towards Gilgamesh, longing to kiss him? The personal God, breathing upon the page, like everyone else, whenever I want to speak to somebody else, or else alone in the house, alone in my head, hearing my own voice trying to say it right, not getting it right, my own voice breathing towards me, trying to say how it is, where it is that it's coming from down there. I know that a number of my friends here are poets and writers, and some of you are writers too in the creative writing course, and I'm hoping that some of these things are, in a sense, familiar to the experience of writing. And I want to read one other poem that has to do with that, an older poem, of what I think happens in a poem, and I think happens not because the poem goes according to prior plan, in a sense, but because the poem finds out where it's going and creates various forms. And it's called Of Rhyme. The task is the discovering of a rhyme whose consequence is just, though unforeknown, either in its completion, having been prepared for, though in secret, all the time, or in the way each step of the way brings in to play with one another in the game, considerations hitherto unknown. New differences, discovering the same. The discovering is an ordering in time, such that one seems to chance upon one's own birth name, strangely engraved upon a stone, in consequence of the completion of the rhyme. And at the completion of the poem, working on something, you are finding out. That's what I meant by two voices, in a sense, in that other poem. You are finding out some other voice that's somehow defining who you are on that occasion, to some degree, and, of course, distrusting what you've found out. The other night, I had the pleasure of reading, thanks to Sasan Tabatabai the core program, of participating in a reading of poems, and because it's spring and getting to be nicer weather than we've suffered from, I want to read a passage from Virgil's Georgics, just because I'm crazy about it. And goats deserve no less than sheep deserve. What they provide's no less than sheep provide. Miletian fleece, dyed with Tyrian purple, will to be sure be sold for more, and yet the nanny goats produce more offspring and more milk. The more the milk from the udders richly foams in the milking pail, the more it richly flows from the pressed teats at the next milking. The billy goats' gray beards and bristly coats are clipped to make a rough cloth for army camps and jackets for shivering sailors against the cold. When spring comes round again, the goats are able to forage in woods and on the Lycaean heights, feeding on brambles and mountain-loving briar, and they know the way to come home all by themselves, with their kids following after, the she-goat's udders so full that they can scarcely clear the threshold. The more they get along without your help, the more they need the help that you can give them, sheltering them from the wind and from the cold, bringing them twigs to eat for sustenance, and leaving your hay bins open all winter long. But let us eagerly go now, seeking the cool fields where joyful summer, called to do so by zephyrs in the early mornings, ascends the sheep and goats out to the glades and pastures, when the first star, Lucifer, appears, and the day is new, and the fields are hoary because of the dew that clinging to the tender grass is most pleasing to the flocks. Then, later in the morning, when everywhere the querulous cicadas complain in every bush, and the flocks are thirsty, I'll take them down to drink from brooks or pools or the wells where water runs through oaken channels to quench their thirst. And after that, at noon, when the day is at its hottest, seek out with them somewhere some shady place where Jove's great oak spreads out its giant arms from its ancient trunk, or a grove that lies in the holy darkness caused by the congregated shade of ilex trees. Then lead them in the afternoon back down to drink from those pure, murmuring, trickling waters, and pasture them again till sunset comes, when vesper, the evening star arising, brings its coolness to the air, and the dew that falls from the risen moon refreshes the waiting glades, and the halcyon bird is heard along the shore, and finches in the trees and all the thickets. Isn't that great? And there's another poem of his that I put in my book for the same reason. It's from the Georgics, from book two, and it's a poem about spring. It's spring that adorns the woods and groves with leaves. In spring, the soil desiring seed is tumid, and then the omnipotent Father God descends in showers from the sky and enters into the joyful bridal body of the earth. His greatness and her greatness in their union, bringing to life the life waiting to live. Birdsong is heard in every secluded thicket, and all the beasts of the field have become aware that love's appointed days have come again. The generous earth is ready to give birth, and the meadows ungirdle for zephyr's warming breezes. The tender dew is there on everything. The new grass dares entrust itself to the new sons of the new days, and the little tendrils of the young vines have no fear of a south wind coming, nor of a north wind from a stormy sky. The vine brings forth its buds, its leaves unfold. I think it must have been that just such days as these were the shining days when the world was new. Everywhere it was spring, the whole world over. The east wind held in check its winter winds. The beasts draw in the light of that first dawn. The first men, the beasts drank in the light of that first dawn. The first men born of the earth raised up their heads from the stony ground. The woods were stacked with game, and the first stars came out in the sky above. Nor could the tender plants endure their lot if spring's relief were not to intervene between the heat of summer and winter's cold. I'd like to read another translation from Montale, News from Mount Amiata. By later tonight, the fireworks of the storm will be a swarming of bees below the horizon. I'm writing this letter to you at a wooden table whose wood the insects and worms have gotten into. The beams are pockmarked with their ravenous feasting. A smell of melon mildew rises from the floor. As from the valley rises the valley smoke, as if it were the smoke of mushrooms clouding my window. Here, in the rich core of the world, in this room, in this honeycomb, mealy, fragrant, innermost cell of a sphere launched out across the luminous skies, you who are elsewhere and other dwell in another cell and center of things. But here at this table, writing to you, in front of this fire, the chestnuts lavishly burst themselves open upon the hearth of, that life is too brief that invokes your absent presence against the glowing background as of an icon. Outside the windows, the rain is falling. If you were to make your way among the ancient, feeble, soot-blackened buildings, time has made that way, and along the alleys between them and through the courtyards, where in the middle there is a wellhead where the well goes down forever and forever, if you could follow the heavy flights of nightbirds down the alleys to where, beyond the ravine, the galaxy glimmers, the matrix of our torment. But the only step that echoes along the darkness is that of someone by himself who sees shadows of doorways falling, shadows collapsing. The threads between the stars are lost to sight. The clock in the campanile is stopped at 2. Even the vines that climb the ancient walls are shadows that climb in the dark. North wind, come down. Unloosen the hands that clutch the sandstone walls. Scatter the books of hours on the attic floors. Clear all away, cold wind, and then let all be clearness of sight that has dominion over the mind that does not know how to despair. Cold wind, seal up the spores from which the tendrils sprout that their climb as shadows the ancient walls. These alleys are too narrow. The donkey hooves that clatter in the darkness on a cobbles strike sparks. The unseen mountain peak above replies to with magnesium random signals. And off the leaking, slowly deliquescing walls of the huddled houses in the rain, time turning to water, the endless dialogue with the wretched dead, the ashes, oh, the wind, the death that lives. This Christian fuss nothing but words of shadow and of grief. What can I say through them that speaks to you less than the water draining away down the runnels, an old abandoned mill wheel, the trunk of a tree, markers of the limits of the world, pile of litter shakes and disintegrates. At night, the porcupines come out, seeking a trickle of water to pity them. They join my waking vigor to your deep, dreaming sleep. This is a poem from my book, Bewilderment, called Everybody's Tree. The storm broke over us on a summer night, all brilliance and display and being out, dangerously, I thought, on the front porch standing. Over my head, the lightning skated and blistered and sizzled and skidded and yelled in the bursting down around my maybe 14-year-old being. And in spite of all the fireworks up above and what you'd thought would have been the heat of all that exuberant rage, the air was suddenly cool and fresh and as peaceable as could be down on the porch, so different from what it was my body was expecting. The raindrops on the front porch railing arms peacefully dripped as if they weren't experiencing what was coming down from above them as an outrage. My body could reinterpret it as a blessing, being down there in the cool beneath the heat. It wasn't, of course, being blessed, but being suddenly singled out with a sense of being a being. Sometime early in the 19th century, down in the part of New Jersey called New Sweden, someone with some familial link to me, maybe a grandsire down a maternal line, whose name was Isaiah Toy, was sitting up in the house of his dying bachelor uncle, who was also Isaiah Toy. And Isaiah Toy, his uncle, would leave his farm to Isaiah Toy, his nephew, who was sitting in a chair in the next room to where his uncle was dying. I don't know what kind of light it would have been that he was reading the Bible by while his uncle slept toward leaving the farm to him, when suddenly reading, who was it, Matthew or maybe Mark, the glory of the Lord broke over his head. Or so he said. Methodists got excited when, in the woods of their confusion, suddenly the moonlight burst above their heads, and they were ever after then enlightened beings. Quote, light suddenly broke up upon his mind. For fear of disturbing his dying uncle with his joy, the expression of which he could not repress, he went out of the house into the brilliant moonlight shining upon the snow and gave vent to his feelings, shouting, glory to God in the highest, end quote. Coming back in from the porch, while the storm went on above our little house, I went to close the window of the dining room that looked out back of the house, and I could dimly see the backs of the Bowdoin Street houses all in a row, occasionally lit up and washed blank by downpours of the lightning of the storm. The Becker's house, the Giles's house, the Demarest's, Jean Williams's, where she lay in the sleeping sickness, and Bessie Phelps's house, the next one to hers. The property lines of the houses and their yards made briefly clear by the lightning flashing. Running along the back of the hither yards was a tiny ditch, defining the property lines between where our Yale Street backyards ended and where the yonder Bowdoin Street houses backyards backed up to it. My childhood fantasy thought the waterless tiny ditch was the vestige of a mysterious, long ago bygone, vanished river that came from somewhere else and went somewhere. I didn't know, though of course I knew them. Whatever went on in those houses, or in my mind, or my mother's mind, or my father's asleep upstairs, though I kept wondering, and wonder still, what is it they were doing? Who were they? All are gone, the unfamiliar faces. Over beyond, in the night, there was a houseless wooden lot next door to Bessie's house. Because of the houselessness and because of the trees, I could think of it as a forest, like the forest in Hawthorne's great short story, Young Goodman Brown. And from out that window, looking out at the back, I could faintly see, or thought I could see, maybe once or twice by a flash, a raining gust of the light of lightning, the waving tops of trees in that empty wooded lot beyond Bessie's house. The houseless, tiny lot seemed like a forest. And in the forest, there was a certain tree, which all of us children somehow knew was known as everybody's tree. So it was called, though nobody knew who it was who gave it its name. And on the smooth hide of its trunk, there were initials. Nobody knew who it was who had inscribed them. We children had never gathered around that tree to show each other our bodies. I remember now, crossing through that houseless wooded lot, on my way home on an autumn afternoon, that strange tree where the writing on it seemed ancient, a totem, a rhapsody, playing a music written according to an inscrutable key. How did I ever know what the tree was called? Somebody must have told me. I can't remember. Whoever it was has become a shade imagined from an ancient, unrecoverable past. And this is a poem called Street Scene. It quotes in two places Shakespeare's great sonnet, I forget the number, 55, when I consider everything that grows, holds in perfection but a little moment, that this huge stage presenteth naught but shows, whereon the stars in secret influence comment. I later, I think, learned that the word consider has got stars in it somehow, etymologically. And Shakespeare's poem knew that. I don't know whether Shakespeare knew it when he wrote those four lines, but the fourth line told the first line that that was the case. Whereon the stars and secret influence comment. Street scene. Someone's shadow and the shadow of his dog are what I see through my window looking out across the street. Someone's shadow. And then, as the leaves of the tree just outside my window move a little, this way or that, with the breeze, it's Mr. Wren, taking his dog for a walk, or being out there with his dog in order maybe to be seen as one of us. The two of them standing there, vacant of conversation, his tan shirt, brown pants, bald spot, his trivial pug, absurdly the color of a golden retriever, that this huge stage presenteth naught but shows. The red truck that was parked in the parking lot, that they have walked past without seeming to notice it is now leaving the parking lot. It is as if the man and his dog, both of them, knew that the truck was going to move, because all three of them have become in common elements of the scene that I'm observing. And so all three of them seem to understand that they have a common purpose. The side of the red truck just a moment ago had painted on it in white graphics, Charette. That word was on it when it left my view. Now a blue truck with no letters on its side, so giving no information about its purpose, turns into the parking lot and then backs into the same slot under the overhang of the building. A shifting of the leaves that I'm looking through prevents me from seeing who gets out of the truck and where it is he goes. It is as if the brilliant red truck with the white letters on it outside my range of sight had changed its color. Whereon the stars in secret influence comment. And therefore, it is as if I had imagined the change of color, the vanishing of the one truck, the sudden appearance of the other one. Magic. A trick of magic performed by me. Something that I performed because I saw it. Or the trick was performed by the unseen hand of the world. Charette went out of business in that instant. And what became of Mr. Wren and his dog? Hurled down to the underworld, twisting and turning, the two of them falling, the dog's leash fluttering in the eerie light down there through which they fall. This is a poem also about when I was a kid. Half of my family is Southern, and they all spoke in marvelous tidewater accent, and it felt like I was going somewhere previously unknown to me every time I went. And my aunt had a cottage in a part of Norfolk on a little peninsula called Willoughby Spit. And this is a poem about that. The little fence around the tiny front yard seemed very little, even to a child. Even as a child, visiting there from the north for a week or maybe 2 weeks every summer, I experienced the place as if I had been reading in a book that was written for very young children to read. Vivid, crude, charming, frightening in the way it simplified some truth about the world you didn't know enough to know about. There were a few flowers in the little front yard, ineptly shaped by nature, looking as if someone in a hurry had stuck them in the sand. There were some boards for getting across the sand from the gate to the front porch steps. The boards were burning under your feet with an intensity that took your breath away. It was so hot you could smell the heat of the old gray boards of the little walk and the fence, as if they might burst into smokeless flame at any moment. The sand of the beach across the street was dark. It was a surprise to step on it and find that it was burning dry, although in fact the flat, dull waters of the bay had been known to rise up in rage and smite the shore and get all the way to the road that divides the spit and even across it and even across the sand on the other side of the road, almost to reach the smaller bay beyond. The other houses were mostly those of strangers, though of course not all of them were strangers to Aunt Nellie, but hardly any were friends, since she was bound within the spell of her eccentricity. Since she was bound within the spell her eccentricity drew like a magic circle around her in the sand so none might enter. In the sands behind the houses, there were scrub pines, and living in the woodshed behind Aunt Nellie's house were black widow spiders, so I was told. In the little dark parlor of the house, there was an upright piano, table lamps with lampshades with beads along their lower edges. There was a rocker made of some very dark wood, varnished almost black. A couple of other armchairs, high-backed, perhaps of the same wood, but with needlepoint-covered seats, and one of them with needlepoint oval insets on the arms. On a table, a newspaper called, I think, The Pilot, telling perhaps the story of how a drunken sailor on the roller coaster that used to tower high above the other attractions at Ocean View Amusement Park nearby, like the skeleton of a dinosaur, had stood up just as the car tipped over the highest point of the highest loop, and how he fell straight down to his death while the car plunged down on its thrilling tracks, entirely unconcerned. Or else it was from a Ferris wheel that he fell, just as the wheel had brought him to the top, and when he stood up on the floorboard, the floorboard under his feet seemed to rock back and forth, forward and back and forward. And back and forward, then poured him out over and down, a little figure vividly clear, as he fell in the story I heard of a roller coaster or Ferris wheel back then. How long ago the sailor must have forgotten the manner of his death. On the piano were some pages of sheet music. In the gloaming, oh my darling, when the lights are burning low and the shadows of the evening softly come and softly go. In the summer heat, the door in from the front porch was always a little bit open, but the light from outside got only a little way in. On another table, a candy dish or ashtray decorated with a woman's head with Marcel's golden hair and a Grecian profile expressing some noble outrage or otherwise disturbed emotion, for example, catastrophic loss. There was a curtain, beaded also, I think, between the living room and the dining room that loomed in littleness beyond. There was a huge dining room table and a huge sideboard, the two of them so big you'd have thought the room had to be built around them to get them in, inherited long ago from a larger house, or a wedding present with larger expectations. And next to this was the dark bedroom in which Aunt Nellie and her husband, Uncle Frank, slept together in sexless affection, as if in secret collusion. On the bedroom dresser, there was a hairnet, a box containing pins, straight pins and safety, mixed in with jewelry, brooches, earrings, bracelets, and other such things. They glinted in the darkness of the room. In the sand, out back of the house, there were those little black or dark purple pods or pod-like things, some kind of seaweed, which on the beach up north in New Jersey, I like to pick up and burst between my fingers. But here, because of the spiders, they reminded me of them, and I didn't touch them. Aunt Nellie's picture was in the paper once, triumphantly posing with a large bottle, black widow spiders inside, looking out, as conscious as fireflies of their situation. This is a poem, I guess, about myself. It's at the beginning of the last book. And everybody's poems were about himself, right? But, sorry. called Narcissus. There's the one about the man who went into a telephone booth on the street, called himself up, and nobody answered because he wasn't home. So how could he possibly have answered the phone? The night went on and on and on and on. The telephone rang and rang, and nobody answered. And there's the one about the man who went into the telephone booth and called himself up, and right away he answered. And so they had a good, long heart-to-heart far into the night. The sides of the phone booth glittered and shone in the light of the streetlight light as the night went echoing on. Out in the wild hills of suburban New Jersey, up there above South Orange and Maplewood, the surface of a lofty of a lonely pond iced over under the avid breath of the winter wind, and the snow drifted across it and settled down, so at last you couldn't tell that there was a pond. And this is a poem called 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's five little poems, each five lines long, each of them centering around one of five words. Anger. Anger is what I don't know what to do with. I know it was anger was the trouble that other time. I don't know where the anger came from that time, or where it was I was going on anger's back on a mission to somewhere to get me through the danger. Whatever. Whatever it is, I think I probably know. However, whatever it is, I keep from knowing. No, it is not whatever I think I know. Maybe I'll never know whatever it is. Someday it has to be figured out. Whatever. Somebody. Somebody's got to tell me the truth someday. And if somebody doesn't tell me the truth, I'll tell it. On my block there was somebody knew the truth, I think, or so I thought. Anyway, somebody knew that trying to tell the truth is looking for somebody. Isn't. If it isn't anywhere, I guess it isn't. But if it is, isn't, why do I think it is? I guess there really isn't any way for me to find out what is or isn't there in the black night, where it either was or wasn't, and where. Where was it? I was looking in the past. It isn't where I've looked. That's no surprise. I don't know what or where it is or was, but maybe it isn't too much the where, but the why, or maybe I haven't found it because beware. And I'd like to conclude with three short poems, I think. One of them is, my wife and I have worked for a long time at a supper for street people at a church in Boston, and some of my poems have come from that experience. This one is a free verse poem called Coffee Lips. And like all the poems I've been reading to you, it seems to be about not being able to figure it out, so what are we going to do? Coffee Lips. The guest who came into the street people's suppers last night an elderly man with a lost, smart little boy's face and a look as if he might turn against you anytime soon, as if he'd just come into the world and he was extremely wary about what the world was going to be. And he said, "If I ask you a question, will you give me a truthful answer?" And I said, "That depends on what the question is," thinking the little elderly boy looked sophisticated and as if he'd in fact been a long time in the world and would get the tone right. And maybe he did, or maybe he didn't. At any rate, he went on to ask the question, "When I come into places like this and there are people holding coffee cups to their lips and they look at me, are they about to drink the coffee or not to drink the coffee?" He was balancing the world on the tip of his unknowing nose. I felt like I was falling down someplace else than anywhere there. And this is also Incubus at the Supper for Street People. The young man who goes all muffled up from harm with whatever he has found, newspaper pages carefully folded to make a weirdly festive hat or hood down almost over his eyes, everything carefully arranged to make him other, the paper-covered razor blade in his mouth, or the bit of wood, like carrying a message, a fantasy so clever, outwitting itself, that it became what it was. I'm sorry, that it became a fantasy so clever, outwitting itself, that it became what it was he was, and so he was what it was. The long, loose shirt, too big for him. The pantaloons too big for him, loose, like the pantaloons of the circus clown. Some kind of jacket too big, he got it somewhere. His burden slept dreaming everywhere upon him, as if his whole body and his clothes were dreaming of his condition, and the dream came true. His clothes slept on him as if they were his lover. And this is a translation from a Rilke poem, Das Lied des Zwerges, the Song of the Dwarf, which I call At the Street Corner. "Maybe my soul's all right, but my body's all wrong, all bent and twisted. It's this that hurts me so. My soul keeps trying to straighten my body up. It hangs on my skeleton, frantic, flapping its terrified wings. Look here, look at my hands. They look like little wet toads after a rainstorm's over, hopping, hopping, hopping. Maybe God didn't like the look on my face when he saw it. Sometimes a big dog looks right into it." And I think I'll conclude with two very early poems of mine that I put into this very late book just because they show me that I'm still sort of the same person I was then. This is called The Late Hour Poem. "In an hour of furious clarity, by liquor made, full of a fierce charity, my harp I played. I made a loud uproar. I went in turn from door to every door. Marry or burn, love your neighbor, I cried. Pity the poor, divided people who side by side here lie, transfixed in sleep, and shadow covers each eye. On house and house the echo rang and rebounded. My harp made everybody know how brave I sounded." And the last poem is At a Bar. It's in four stanzas. The fourth line of each stanza rhymes with the fourth line of the others. while in a bar, I bore indignity with those others whose hearts were sore or sour or sick or such as made them humankind. I looked into my glass to see if I could find something to give me ease. Narcissus at the pool, I looked lovingly at my own disordered fool, who would not tell me much, but stared patiently back. He would not tell me what I'd ever have or lack. He would not tell me that. I looked along the bar and saw my fellow creature bravely standing there. By word, sign, or touch, I cried in my mute heart, tell me, be my teacher, be learned in that art. What is my name and nature? My pulse ticked in my wrist. The noon hung around unawares. Outside, the traffic passed, like quiet cattle or such, standing about a pool, dumb, ignorant creatures, my fellow, myself, my fool, ignorant of our natures. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a reading by American poet David Ferry, presented by the Poetry Reading Series at the College of General Studies. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 800-909-9287. That's 800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Kalo. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lightodes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.